Welcome back, y'all, to Sidewalk Small Talks, where we do history and talk about cities. I'm your host, Evelyn, and I am so excited to share with you all a park which I never thought I would visit, not to mention about learning its backstory. And before I go deeper, I really want to apologize for just failing off the schedule of this season. There was some technical issue that popped up in my editing of, I think, my third episode, which was about the Korean legation. And alongside that, some other issues just popped up in the whole podcast planning and just my life in general. And so that those stuff pulled away my attention. But the good news is we're back now and we're back on track. And so, yeah, I am so stoked to pretty much end this year and almost ending this season with a really cool episode about a place that is outside of the US and a place that has captivated my mind, especially its history and its significance and its design. Like, everything about it pretty much captivates my mind. And I have fond memories of sharing of this place to the people around me once I came back to the US during the fall. So as we are heading to another Olympic year, which is 2024, I am so very thrilled to share with you all an Olympic Park during my first trip to Europe. And I am also equally, if not more, elated to share with y'all about the urban history related to the planning of this Olympic Park that has captivated my mind. So it all started with my first trip to Europe over the fall this year. I went to Munich, Germany for the first time during the last days of Oktoberfest this year. And my original plan for the trip was really just to see a high school friend whom I hadn't seen for 5 years. And during my stay in Munich, I went to this park after seeing recommendations on some influencers' Instagram reels and decided to catch a sunset there. And it is called the Olympia Park, which hosted the 1972 Munich Olympic Games. Like, my trip to Munich is almost like spontaneous. I bought the tickets like a month prior. Somebody would, someone would argue with me that if you buy your tickets a month prior, it's not spontaneous. But to me, a type A person, it is spontaneous. And honestly, I didn't do too much of like planning for my trip to Munich because obviously I have a friend who is there. And so my plan was just to follow my friend. And also, I was like right after my trip from Canada. And so I was basically just not in the mood for planning for Munich. And I just, had an open heart and open eyes to explore the city. And I'm so glad that this city did not fail my zero expectations, if that makes sense. And in a matter of fact, I got to see a very beautiful part of the city and being able to learn about its backstory. And so, long story short, the contemporary design of the Olympia Park of Munich, as well as the vibes that it gave off, put me into disbelief that it was built for more than 50 years ago, because it hosted the 72 Olympic Games, and obviously it has to be built before 72. So it's definitely more than 50 years ago, but if you have ever stepped foot into the Olympia Park, you cannot tell that it's 50 plus years old because it feels so futuristic even in today's standards. So for those of you who have never been, I 100% would recommend you just visiting if you ever have any plans to stop by in Munich. And so essentially, I came back from Munich and I was in between jobs at that moment, and I had a lot of time to sit around. So I dug into the history of the park only to be more amazed by how much thought was put into the design of it and the success of the said design in delivering a thriving and democratic neighborhood within this park. And as you know, the way I titled this episode, I call it Democracy Goals. And later in the episode, you'll understand how design really facilitates social life and even facilitates civic participation. And that's one of the things that I find so mind-blowing about this park. So definitely stay tuned. But essentially, this park is arguably one of the hashtag goal for park design, not only because it's so adaptive to the urban fabric of Munich during the post-games reuse, but the fact that its ability to house a very thriving and vocal neighborhood within the park itself and blend that within the urban fabric of Munich, that is kind of the reason why we like enthrone this park in this episode, if that makes sense. So before I go too far, I would like to flag that my digging or my research into the backstory of this park is very limited, and in somewhat it's a little bit biased since I don't understand German. All of my sources are in English, and I highly relied on the writings of a British historian, Kay Schiller, who specializes in contemporary German history, especially Western Germany, at Durham University. So, coming back to the Olympia Park, it is the site where the Olympic Village and most sporting venues are concentrated in Munich. It was an airport until 1968, and then it became a brownfield site. So a brownfield site is a place that is no longer in use, awaiting for new development. And so people were trying to figure out what to do with this closed down airport or abandoned airport. And so prior to being an airport, this place, this current site of Olympia Park, had since the 18th century been an army camp, a parade ground, horse racing track, airfield for zeppelins and hot air balloons, and the city's first civilian airport, according to historian Kay Schiller. And in fact, the current Olympic Mountain in the park used to be, when translated to English, the Rubel Mountain, which contains 10 million cubic meters of rubel from the Allied bombing raids on the city during World War II. And that's also from our lovely historian Kay Schiller. And so, according to historian Schiller, the Olympic Park played a vital role in Munich's environmental renewal and making use of a brownfield site in the north of the city in an area characterized by industry, sewage works, garbage dumps, railway yards, military installations, and airports. So, based on historian Kate Schiller, the current site of the Olympia Park is basically an urban renewal success story. And a little bit of history into the design and like the whole planning thoughts that was put into Olympia Park. There were these designers and planners who historian Kay Schiller called technocrats in Germany, who had great ambitions for the Olympia Park, and they had their thoughts, they had their theories that guided them to design what Olympia Park is right now. And so they all share this consensus that the park is to reflect a broader discourse of democracy in congruence with Western Germany's efforts to show the world that a brand new Germany is able to keep democracy after the world wars. And they really do believe that democracy in modern industrial countries could be improved, and that social issues and problems could be solved through careful planning of experts like themselves. And so when they're designing the Olympic Village, for instance, they even hired a social psychologist. And the result of thoughtful and interdisciplinary planning all reflects the goal to design environments that could contribute to resolving the tensions between community and individual, work and leisure, and public and private spheres. So essentially, when these planners, when these architects and designers come together to design a park, they have a very specific and ambitious goal to make this park a park that is conducive to healthy social living. And that has been a core value that they upheld throughout their planning, and which is essentially, you know, a lamp that has guided the way they designed this park and the space. So concretely speaking, an epitome of this actualized vision is encapsulated in the separation of pedestrian and motorized traffic at the Olympic Village. in which 80% of village entrances lead to the ground, where it's designed for pedestrians and car parking being relegated underground. So this design is essentially revolutionary. And it's very ahead of the curve because drive-in culture was still very much the trend in West Germany, where they were imitating the American lifestyle. So having the Olympic Village doing this whole separation of vehicles and pedestrian is honestly revolutionary, even when it's put in today's world. Having this whole separation of different forms of traffic is mind-blowing in my mind, and I just find it so cool, and I don't know if it's replicable in other areas, but it's definitely ahead of the curve, and it's definitely something that I would really want to flag when it comes to talking about the design of this park, because if you separate vehicles and pedestrians, it dramatically increases the safety of this community. People are more likely to walk. And when more people come out and congregate and walk, that's where, you know, social bonding happens. And cars, or essentially people hiding inside of their cars and driving around, does not create the same experience or does not create the same social bonding opportunities than a safe, pedestrianized area can do. And so essentially the result of this great design of Olympic Village, for those who grew up in the village, there seems to exist a general agreement, quote, that compared to other city children, they experienced a far greater degree of freedom in an exciting environment that brought together urban and natural elements, and that, due to the absence of car traffic, was very safe. Quote, some of those folks who grew up in the village even expressed interest to return when they have children. So essentially, I think these two quotes, what they really tell us is not only the cool design that the Olympic Village has, but also the fact that how sustainable and like how long it can, you know, be still in, it can still be in use, right? Like, kids literally grew up in the Olympic Village after the games, so when young families, when their parents moved them in, and now that they've grown up, they would even consider moving back in for their children. And you can see just how like the village is adapted into the modern life, the modern city life of Munich. So switching gears here, I think it's a good opportunity to fit Munich and the Olympic Games into the historical context for a moment. Essentially, the period we're talking about is the height of the Cold War. And in a matter of fact, the first couple lines in the monograph about the 1972 Munich Olympics, written by, again, historian Kay Schiller and Christopher Young, were quotes of a telephone conversation between President Nixon and Henry Kissinger over whether the U.S. government should invite Boris Spassky, a Russian chess grandmaster who lost to the U.S. player Bobby Fischer in the 1972 games, over for a White House visit or celebration, some sort of things. So it's very interesting to me that this whole monograph that's essentially dedicated to talking about the 1972 Munich Olympic Games has their beginning with this whole telephone conversation between President Nixon and Henry Kissinger, you know, two American dudes who shouldn't have anything to do with the Munich Olympic Games. But I think with these dialogue being shown in the first page of the introduction, it really highlights the Cold War atmosphere that the 1972 Olympic Games was set. So therefore, as much as the Olympic Games was about sports, it was also about politics. And I think that applies to basically all the Olympic Games, because it's so hard to divorce sports from politics. It just cannot, you know, that's not happening. Like, people try, but somehow sports and politics are so intermingled, and they really reflect each other, if that makes sense. And I don't think this Yeah, I don't think this squarely applies to 1972 games, but essentially all the games across the board. And speaking from a political aspect that we all hate, Munich was bearing a heavy burden of presenting a Germany that was in line with the rest of the Western world when it comes to its level of democracy. And the Federal Republic of Germany, from now on, we'll call it the Federal Republic, especially wanted the games to redeem its image from the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games, which was pretty much a stage for Nazi propaganda. And a matter of fact, a journal article that examines Olympic designs remarks that a notorious example of strong monumental and symbolic character is the Olympic city of Berlin in the 1936 Olympic Games, with an architecture of monumental and symbolic nature which stood as a transmitted station for political propaganda. And by the way, for the previous quote that I just read, it was quoted from that journal article. And so basically with a hope to wash itself away from the notorious political past that Germany inherited, the architects of the 1972 Munich Olympic Games had a strong desire to do the exact opposite from what was done in the 1936 Berlin Games. So quoting Schiller again, there will be in the 1972 Games no displays of nationalism, no gigantism. Sport will not be seen in relation to military discipline or as preparation for it. Pathos will be avoided. Depth is not always expressed in seriousness. Lightness and nonconformity are also indicators of a respectable subjectivity. The Munich Olympic Games shall have the character of informality, openness, lightness, and cheerfulness. And in order to achieve this, Signage even invited visitors to like walk on the lawns and pick the flowers, and even policemen were did not wear any typical police uniforms, but light blue clothing. And that is quoted from the CEO of Olympia Park, who received an interview, I think from an American media company, in I think September of this year. She mentioned that like policemen in the 72 games didn't even wear typical police uniforms, but like, you know, light blue casual clothing. So that was, you know, how much effort that they've put into creating an Olympic Games that is divorced from politics. But it's also funny that, you know, even though they are trying really hard to erase all forms of identifiable political message propaganda, but they're doing it, you know, to deliver this whole ideal of democracy, which in itself is a political message, right? You know, democracy, democratic society, all these ideals per se are political. So I find it's really funny, because as much as the 72 games is trying to writ itself and like, you know, rebrand themselves from the 36 games, which was characterized by politics and political messages, what they do in the 72 games is essentially the exact opposite, but also not divorcing itself from political messaging, if that makes sense. So I find that paradox very interesting. And so essentially the 72 Olympic Games was more than just a project for urban renewal for Munich City, but also one that could possibly redefine the image of Germany itself after having a lasting negative representation in recent history. So therefore Munich, or more specifically the planners, architects, and organizers of the 1972 Games, was caught in this whole paradox again of avoiding political messaging while messaging to the world that the Federal Republic is mature with democracy while designing the Olympia Park. And next off, I kind of want to go deep into the bid and the financing of the games, which at the end of the day is quite a multi-level of government cooperation. And so who we have over here is Munich's mayor, whose last name is Vogo. I do not want to put myself into embarrassment by mispronouncing his name, so I'll just use his last name. Quick and sweet and simple and easy to identify. So Vogo was a young and dynamic mayor, and he was so inspired by American post-war urban critics, if that makes sense. And so these urban critics include John Kenneth Galbraith, who wrote The Affluent Society, and Jane Jacobs, who wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And Vogo had been so concerned for some time about the fabric of modern society. In it, he saw a world, quote, increasingly defined by a disparity between private wealth and public poverty, spending on trivial consumer needs over vital communal services, and an unnatural functionalist division between work and living spaces. And by the way, that was a quote from historian Kay Schiller again. So yeah, essentially we have a mayor in Munich who was so dynamic, and who was having this heart to create communal spaces and closing up the gap between, you know, the rich and poor, and making sure that communal services are prioritized, and the whole, I think, urban life being revitalized instead of being characterized by division. And so with the Olympic Games, Munich would be able to allow itself to have this whole ideological rescoping, quote unquote, and to resell itself to the founders' belief in the harmony of sports and the arts. That was a quote from Kay Schiller as well. And so one thing that made Munich a very favorable candidate was that it already approved the Brownfield site by city council for future use as a stadium, and it simply awaited funding. And so there are, you know, prep work in terms of selecting sporting venues. So some of the work has already been done, and all they basically have to do is to make sure there is funding going into the construction of sporting venues. So you can pretty much conclude that Munich is ready to do something big and to host like big sporting events. And so coupled with strong political will from Mayor Vogel to have a Munich city becoming more communal, if that makes sense, or becoming more better in terms of having infrastructure that bridges people together, Munich was in a really good shape into hosting a big event that can rewash or rebrand the image of West Germany. And so, however, Munich was financially struggling by 1965, with its budget covering around 2/3 of expenditure on roads, housing, schools, and hospitals on credit. And Munich attracted more returnees and who evacuated after the war than any other West German city. So basically, we have this city with growing population at a very rapid rate, with a net gain of 110,000 between 2 years, between 1969 to 1971. And it also has the youngest population in the Federal Republic, so it desperately needs an upgrade for its infrastructure. And it really needs some type of policies in place to rebalance the positives and negative consequences of its post-war boom. And so with all of these factors, you know, Munich having a brownfield site already approved to build a stadium, and with all these population boom and this sudden inflow of people, refugees, and a rapidly younger population, you know, it's ready for a big sporting event to take place. And so eventually the communal institutions were priorities for new infrastructure, and the city of Munich only paid Deutschmark 31 million of the Deutschmark 490 million of the whole Olympic Games budget. And by the way, Deutschmark was the currency of West Germany back in the days. And Bonn, which was basically the capital of West Germany, paid most of the money for the Olympic Games construction. And the state of Bavaria, which is where Munich sits, also really supports the Olympic Games because the state is also anticipating the spillover effects that the new sporting infrastructure and tourism the Games would bring, and especially in attracting young people. Because for events like soccer, you know, they held the competitions in Passau, Ingolstadt, Augsburg, and Nuremberg. And so it's not just Munich, but also like its neighboring cities. And even for handball, like this event wasn't even held in Bavaria. It was held in Baden-Württemberg. Okay, somebody correct my pronunciation. But essentially, like Baden-Württemberg was like another state right next to Bavaria. So on the state level, or quote unquote on the land level, which Kay Schiller would prefer, they got support. They got a lot of support for the anticipated spillover effects that the Munich Olympic Games would bring. And on the federal level, which is the hardest to convince, it still got a green light from the federal level. Chancellor Earhart wasn't quite sure about Vogo's Deutschmark 490 million budget for the Games, but he rapidly changed his mind because he knew that hosting the Games would be a great opportunity to rebrand not just Munich itself, but Germany as a country that has stepped out from the post-war era and is ready for the future. So we talked so much about, you know, before the Games, the planning, the technocrats, and even some of the, you know, city, land, and federal opinions on the Games. I want to switch gears and talk about after the Games and how it is from then till now. So essentially, the Olympia Park is managed by OMG, the Olympia Park Munich or München GmbH, which is a short form of basically company. And so the park was managed by a holding company fully owned by the city of Munich. And this company basically manages the sporting venues and the park itself. And the Olympic Village, on the other hand, has its own neighborhood association. So what I find so fascinating is that people moved into the village 1 week after the Games. So essentially, quite different from a lot of these Olympic Games where they have the Olympic Village being turned into luxury condos that sit forever and never gets sold. The Olympic Village of the Munich Games is quickly filled by people moving in. And the village housing has since been so not only functional to house people, but also conducive to healthy social interactions. And there are families living in the Olympic Village and also university students. And I think 1/4 of the housing are dedicated for university students. So basically the entire community of the Olympic Village is pretty young. And in fact, the population here is very transient too, right? Because college students, for every 4 years, it's a new batch of, you know, or maybe even every year, depending on how you look at it. You constantly have new people moving in. So it's a really transient, very young community. And with this high level of transience, the residents of the village managed to maintain a very strong cohesion with each other. They founded their own association, which is a piece of evidence, and not to mention that this neighborhood association publishes their own magazine. And if I remember that correctly, the magazine is published on a quarterly basis. And on top of having a very strong social cohesion among residents, this neighborhood association has a strong political voice as well. And in that they once asked a nearby chemical plant to relocate in 1993. And also within 3 years, between 2011 and 2014, They formed a community cooperative, which then bought two commercial properties in the village and rented these two commercial properties out to businesses whose main aims are to bring benefit to the village in order to avoid chain stores invading into the village. Thus, it creates a buffer for the first steps of gentrification. Perhaps the most striking example of their political strength would be their successful fight against the building of a soccer arena for the 2006 FIFA World Cup and opposing Munich to apply for the 2018 Winter Olympics. Their opposition to the park hosting mega sports events may be due to the fear of overwhelming tourists and the potential of gentrification. I'm not exactly sure about their rationale, but what I really want to draw attention to is the fact that this neighborhood association has a political voice strong enough to halt developments of the park for sporting purposes for which it was originally designed. And I think that this level of political voice is really unmatched, right? Like, the whole entire Olympic Park and its village was designed to host sporting events. But now we see the people who are living, who are inhabiting the village, having such a strong voice to even oppose purposes that was originally placed in the building of this park. So I find it, I'm not sure if fascinating is the right word, but I'm mind blown, you know, by how much they can achieve and how strong they can stand for what they want and what they do not want. And so definitely for the Olympic Village of the Munich 72 Olympic Games, it is a success story of filling, you know, that village housing and making sure that people are having at least a decent life in there. And I think the civic participation and also like just the internal neighborhood association work that is presented, that is shown in here, really reflects how successful the village was designed. Because compared to other Olympic Games where they have their village housing turned into luxury apartments that sits there for like years and never get a flat sold out, what's happening in Munich right now, it's like great success. Like, I don't have better words for that. So, which I think is why I call this park, you know, Democracy Goals, because not only that they are filling people in the Olympic Village housings, they are also, you know, like the design or like the people that they get to fill into the village are just so conducive to a democratic process, you know, a civic participation and essentially elements of a democratic society. So, I mean, personally, I think it is beautiful to see this and to know this development of the village and the people that live in this village. So after talking about so much, I guess, heavier or harder to digest topics, I just kind of want to share a little bit about what I saw when I was traveling. And so basically, while I was there, I remember that there were literally almost no signs of the Olympic Games. And like, I can't even tell that it used to host an Olympic Games. And honestly, even though it is shameful to admit that I didn't know the Olympia Park was called the Olympia Park because it hosted the 72 Olympic Games, I was just not marketed by its Olympic legacy, if that makes sense, but rather by the fact that it's one of the parks with the best view to watch sunset in Munich. So as much as there is marketing in, you know, the travel industry for this park, people often mention the enjoyability of the park per se, rather than it once being a home to an Olympic Games. That's like what I find so fascinating about like Yeah, people, some travel websites, some travel blogs would say, oh, that's where they held the Olympic Games. But when you walk into it, you don't feel like you're walking into an Olympic arena. You feel like you're walking into a really big futuristic park where locals do their thing, you know, enjoy sunsets, do picnics, they jog, they bike, they have their kids run around there. It feels local. It feels down to earth. And I think my visit confirms the enjoyment as well. The turf and pathways are very well maintained in the park. Separation of bike paths and pedestrian roads are very clear. And there are areas of the park which draw tourists, especially the BMW Museum and the overpriced restaurants. But the majority of the land mass was just like another urban park where you have folks ranging from all ages on the spectrum and just chilling and having their best time. And another thing I find particularly cool is that there were a bunch of white girls doing K-pop dance on this outdoor stage in the park with a pretty much like an amphitheater setup. And so while I was there, it seems as if it was just, you know, a teenager hangout kind of casual event, but it's definitely not like a dance competition or anything fancy or, you know, structured, if that makes sense. It was basically just a group of 20 or so white girls with two loudspeakers playing K-pop music and dancing. And I think this scene really points to the internationality that this park was intended for, right? It was once designed for an international competition with great ambitions to host one of the largest scale of exchange of cultures and the congregation of nations. And after 50 years, the convergence of cultures took place at the exact same place in the most simple, lighthearted activity of dances among teenagers. So I really do believe that the architects who drew out plans for this park would be very touched by the scene if they ever have a chance to see it themselves. But yeah, wrapping up, I just wanted to say that I have so much more planned for this episode because it's such a park with an impressive backstory. But since I wanted this episode to have a more cohesive main idea, I weeded out a lot of the cool details I would like to mention, which leads me to saying that if you want to learn more about this park, there is actually a whole monograph written on the 1972 Olympic Games called The 1972 Munich Olympic Games and the Making of Modern Germany, written by Kay Schiller and Christopher Young. It touches on mainly the political aspect of the games, which we spend rather little time diving into. And there are also countless of academic readings on the internet about the design of Olympia Park as well, especially the roof, which cost a lot of money, and they almost doubled the budget of the Olympic Games. But most of these more technical areas of academic writings or documentation are mostly in German. So if you can read German, good for you. If you can't, and if you have some type of software that can translate documents, you can also go into and like dig deep into the design of it and learn more about that. In any case, I am so very elated to share with you all this rich backstory of Munich's Olympia Park. Never had I ever thought that I would dig into the history of just a random place I visited after learning about it through Instagram. So it definitely will be one of my favorite travel highlights of the year. And so thank you so much for staying till here with me. And I really hope that you enjoyed this episode. If you do, be sure to rate this podcast a 5-star. And before I talk to you guys again in the next episode, which will be the last episode of the season, please, y'all, have a great time and get ready for the holidays. By the way, Merry Christmas, y'all.